Okay.
I said, I always felt that we had to have that remarkable faculty at Rand School, because so many of them had been almost handpicked before they had made the change to the Board of Education taking over. And the faculty was picked from all over the country. I mean, they're specialists in their fields. We were very, very fortunate. And I was very happy to be one of them. I didn't know whether I deserved to be or not, but at least I felt at home. I felt very comfortable with them. I had been educated abroad, and I had had a very fine education in New York State, and Brooklyn, New York, and Vassar College, and I'd had very fine teaching experience before I came here, so I felt very comfortable with these people who I really respected. There were a great many on the faculty whom I really respected very much. But I also felt there were many other fine teachers in other schools, both especially when they went over, they broke up, you know, when South started. I knew some of the faculty at South. Of course, I got to know the teachers at the other schools when we went to AAUW meetings, because we all came together there, the American Association of University Women meetings. We all met those. And I felt that there were some just as fine teachers in other schools as we had. But of course, they came later. I mean, these were developed more later. And here was a school that was already established. And we had our traditions established. And we had our ideals established. And we felt that we had a good deal to offer. And I hope we did. And sometimes faculty, I had a letter the day from someone way down in Florida, telling what she remembered what the Rand faculty had done for her, and that they, the fact that they had meant so much to had encouraged her. She came from a family where she didn't have very many advantages, and she said they didn't look down on me at all. She said they encouraged me. They told me I could do it, and I did. But she said if I'd gone into a faculty that had said, "Oh, well, you don't know very much, you do what you can, we'll let you through." Well, she said, I've had an entirely different future. But she said, we really had. But I know at least a half a dozen people in the South High faculty. And I've known people in the East High faculty. And Cheney, all those people I knew. I didn't know so many of the faculty at Ursuline, but I have met quite a good many Ursuline people, students whom I have liked. But I didn't happen to know the faculty. I suppose our different religion, you know, made it we weren't thrown together as much.
So there really wasn't what you call a superiority complex.
I didn't feel that. I suppose perhaps maybe some people felt that because we had people like Mrs. Peterson and Mrs. Baldwin, who were good. And I knew they were, and maybe some people felt that they thought they were a little better than other people. But for my friends, those were the older people when I came in, you see, Mrs. Peterson as well. They were fine teachers. They had a wonderful background. They had excellent teachers. But when I came in, my group, around 30, you know, late 20s, early 30s, that whole group that came in at that particular time, I didn't feel superior. Now there may have been some who were unforced in giving that impression. That's what I would say. I think there may have been some who were unfortunate, giving an unfortunate that impression. But personally, I never felt superior. Because I found some of my friends that I enjoyed very much came from other high schools, faculty of other high schools.
Now there was a shift around 1926, or part of the continuing shift from the control of Rand being taken from the Board of Trustees and placed in the hands of the Board of Education. Now, did you notice this shift at all? Did it have an effect on you?
Well, maybe some of the faculty may have. It may have been closer, you know, to the administrative end of things. But I wasn't Dean of Girls then. I came in until sometime in the 30s, I think I was Dean of Girls. But the only thing that I, the only point that I was aware of at all at that particular time was a statement made that probably Mr. Miller wouldn't have the chance to choose his faculty now, as he had had when before the Board of Education took over. That was the one thing that impressed me.
Do you think that had a bad effect on this fall?
I think that he might have had to take some people that he might not have chosen if he'd had his choice. But I never heard him say that he chose anybody that he didn't like. But that was the only thing I could think of. That he said, they said at the time, they said, well, now, when it goes to the Board of Education, they'll have more about choosing. And maybe they won't know Ray in school as well as the principal would know it. And consequently, maybe the choice wouldn't be just what he would have chosen, because he would have seen a certain lack on his faculty or a certain need that he could see mirrored in the person who had applied. And yet that might not have been the person that the Board of Education would have thought was the best for the school.
But Mr. Miller never after that said that there was somebody on the faculty whom he...
No, he would be too smart for that.
Did you notice anybody on the faculty who you think would not be Mr. Miller's type?
I wouldn't say it either. I would be too politic for that. There were a few that were different, but as far as I knew, they did the job well.
But you would say, to a certain extent, there was a new, different type of teacher coming in after the Board of Education took over?
I wouldn't dare say that. I would simply say there were a few that were that I didn't know so well. We put that a few that I didn't know so well. But as far as I knew, they did their job well, and I never heard Mr. Miller say they didn't. But I did hear that statement made that they wouldn't be quite as close screening of any applicant as he would have given had he had his choice, which I think is very understandable, which I can see.
Okay. To get back to that thing, just on a typical day, it's nothing, you know,
no.
Very general, just
general day.
Just a general picture of school at the Ray, you know, life at the Ray School during the 20s, 30s, that period in there.
Well, I might take a day when we have a club meeting after class, what's concerned. Well, I generally got there in the morning. We got that on for that now?
Right.
I generally got there in the morning at, as I say, shortly after 7:30, sometimes 20 minutes of 8. And having put away my coat and hat, I'd go to my room, and if I had any flowers on my desk, I always had them watered, had them fixed up ready in case they came in. And I looked over my plan for the day. And I always had on my desk what I was going to teach all during the day, and got my books ready to use when I wanted to. And often about 8 o'clock, some student would come in and say, "Can I ask you a few questions about this or that?" And I would talk with the student perhaps 10 minutes at 8:15. We were supposed to be able to come into homerooms, so they would come in and I'd have a homeroom. And I would take the roll and have to send to the office the names of those who were there and those who weren't there. And I had to make out absent slips for those that had been absent, let them get back into class. And generally in the homeroom period, I would read from the Bible, some message from the Bible, and once in a while I'd bring in a quotation from some famous author that I thought might stick in their mind, you know, something worthwhile, but very, very short, because they would lead off in that 20-minute study, you see, as far as that's concerned. Then after I had done my part and got the things back to the office, they would have about 20 minutes to study, and I would be there in the front of the room, and they would be doing their work, and I'd be fine. And I never thought of any disorder. And then the first class would start, and I'd be, I had to be like to have senior English. think I lasted 15 minutes. I think that's what they were. I'm not sure. But anyway, I have the first class senior English. And then in the second period, I might have a class of sophomore English. And then the third class, I have senior English again. And the fourth period, I'd have my lunch period. And then after lunch, I would have, I'd have another class. I've forgotten just what I might be having. Fifth period. Sixth period, I'd have a study hall. And eighth period, I'd have a senior English again. Senior English again. And sometimes, I mean, once in a while, we're supposed to have, I think we're supposed to have one free period. And if I did have it, that would have been the seventh period. Seventh period, I'd have free then. I'd have a lunch period and seventh period. And one year when the youngsters wanted third year German so badly, and the administration didn't think they could give it to me because they said that after all, there were only, I think there were 11 people that wanted it. And they said, if you'll give up, if you'll take it instead of a study period and teach it, we'll let you have it. And I guess I was an easy mark, so I took it. So that year I worked very, very hard. I didn't have any break except just my lunch period. Then after school, if this was some days, of course, we'd have a German club. And so we'd go down to have a German club meeting. And that would be prepared generally by some people in the German club. But I was either Miss Richards or Miss Beers or I had charge of it. I mean, we'd sit in the back of the room. And then that would sometimes go until about, supposed to be about 3:30, I think. I think 3:15, I think school was out. And about 3:30, the German club started, or 4:15, and that would run for an hour. So after that, we were ready to go home.
What time did you usually get home?
About 5 o'clock, yeah. 5 o'clock.
And what did you do when you came home from school?
Get home from school?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Johnny, when I first came home from school, I threw myself down on the couch. I was simply exhausted. I had given everything I had. Well, I walked home. I mean, it was good for me to walk. And Johnny, I would lie down and just simply try to blot out every thought of anything important for about an hour. And then when I was living in other people's homes, by that time dinner was ready. And when I came here, the younger teachers and I had the shovel together, and we'd have to get dinner. And then in the evening, I'd have to look over senior papers. They had to get ready for college, they'd have to know how to write. So sometimes I'd have a free, sometimes on Saturday I would play.
Like, what would you do, like?
Well, sometimes we'd go out, a crowd of us, the faculty would go out for lunch, you know, together. We'd go out for a ride in the country. One of the faculty had a car, and she liked my company. I liked her company. And we'd drive off into the country and see the coloring in the fall, and chat a bit, get out and walk around Mill Creek Park, something of that kind. Nothing very exciting, but.
It seems that extracurricular activities were very important to the school,
yes.
Both faculty and the students.
Yes, because the faculty backed them. I think that was very important. I think that was one reason for whatever success we had. I think we backed them. I would go to football games, and really I was too tired to go, but at the same time, I know Tom, Dick, and Harry were playing on the team. And I'd make reference to that in the game the next day, you see. And so I would go to them, we'd go to some of the basketball games, and then we'd go to senior dances. When you're 28 or 30, you go to senior dances. I don't go to them now. But those were important. And then the track meet, of course, all the, probably Mr. Pickering told you more about the track things, because he would know more about that. Mr. Irk would know. You know Mr. Irk in town? E-R-C-K. Mr. Franklin Irk. He lives down in Pennsylvania. He was there. He was in the typing department. He taught them. He was in there. He's downstairs. Printing. He was in the printing department. And he was there, I guess, about as long as I was. And he knew the school from that angle. Now, men might have an entirely different viewpoint on the school than women.
In what way?
I don't know. That's what I'm wondering about. I mean, if you talk to him, he might say something very different from what I say.
But you didn't notice any difference between you as a woman teacher as compared to a man teacher?
No. I mean, we were very congenial. I felt that they could give something probably I couldn't give. I could give something they couldn't give. And I thought together, I thought that was one thing about the faculty. We have nice division, men and women. And I think it's very important in the development of our students. I much prefer their having a combination. I think a student who has only one type of teacher, only men or women, loses something very worthwhile.
Now,
but you're bound to get, I don't know what it is, but you're bound to get something from one that you can't get from another.
A lot of the men on the faculty, they worked two jobs, didn't they?
I heard that they did, yes. I wouldn't say a lot of them, but I would say some of them did.
Mm.
I worked two jobs, but not without them, without pay. I mean, you know,
right.
Just, I said that laughingly.
Were there any married women on the faculty at the Rand School? That you can recall?
I don't think it was supposed to be at that time.
Would that lead to a dismissal? Or
I don't know. I know, but I don't believe there. I think I knew anyone at that time that was married.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. One thing is just for personal interest. Did you notice any change in, say, the preference of various students for different authors in your classes? That's through the years. For example, a preference for a certain author in the 20s compared to the 30s or 40s, or even your own change in preference.
Well, that's hard for me to judge intelligently, hard for me to comment on, because in the early years, I had the kind of students that seemed to be very interested in English literature. That was my strength. And they seemed to enjoy, and I think they did, and the things that we talked about English literature. Then the latter years of my teaching, the young people were more interested in books that told about Lindbergh, for instance. And I had one freshman class that I always felt, in fact, I had only one class in my life that I felt I just didn't do as much for as I'd like to. And that kind of class was interested in, when I say, stories about Lindbergh or stories about heroes of the modern age. They weren't especially interested in literature of the past. I think they were more interested in today.
Could you draw any more comparisons and contrasts between students of, say, the 1920s and students of the 50s at the Rand School?
Oh, I don't believe I could.
You could talk about one quality or character, mm-hmm. dedication, things like that.
Well, I think in the earlier years, I mean, I was impressed with the fact that nobody seemed to come unprepared to class. They just thought it was the thing to do. You came prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And I think perhaps in the later years, many were prepared, but a few weren't. Didn't feel that it was vital to their life, vital to their existence, to come with the same kind of dedicated preparation that people used to offer.
Were there any sort of dress regulations in the early period for students?
The Dean of Girls was supposed to determine that. As far as I know, we didn't have any, I don't remember having any regulations about that. Had there been any lack of clothes, if they had come with practically nothing on, and I have heard that there have been cases like that since my time, then it would have been up to me to say, I'm sorry, but we can't have that here. I don't know, Mrs. Peterson before me, of course, is much older. As I told, I looked terribly old as those came in at the time, you know, as she did to me at the time. But I know she would look them over as they came by, and I'm sure she, if she had felt they were unsuitably dressed, she would have told them.
But there was nothing set in the rules.
Not as far as I know, no. As far as I know.
Well, how generally did how did the students generally dress during that period? For example, how would the boys be dressed when they came to school?
I don't remember a lot of jeans in the first part of the year. I don't remember they came there, but they came in suits or a trousers and a blouse, you know, and a shirt, or what I would call a shirt probably. More or less a shirt, like you. And I can't remember, of course, in the winter they had suits, they had jackets and suits. Not so many jeans of questionable appearance at times. Mm-hmm. I can't remember anybody in class looking shabby or unkempt. But of course, we drew a great many students from very fine families, and I think their folks would have expected them to look well. I don't mean that they were dressed in wealthy clothes, but they were neatly dressed, and very many of them were attractive. I used to think it was a privilege to look at them. They were really so attractive. Okay. Neatly dressed, I would say that. But I guess the jeans, after 58, see, I went out in 58. And I think the jeans were prominent after 58. And I think up until I left, most of the students, I'd say most of them, because you always have a few exceptions,
right.
Most of the students were eager to appear well. They didn't want to be called sissies. They didn't want to be called prudish about any appearance, but they wanted to be thought of as well-dressed, nicely dressed. Not extravagantly, just nicely dressed. The girls wore skirts that I can remember, pretty flared skirts, and blouses. When I was young, we used to wear midi blouses. I don't think they wore midi blouses. They wore blouses, pretty blouses and skirts. Blouses and skirts are what I remember. And the boys, trousers and shirts.
Okay.
I don't know what they wear now, but I hear all kinds of things. I don't go near the school anymore because I just couldn't take it.
Did you, during your years there, did you notice any sort of like family lines attending the Rain School?
Yes.
Like you would father,
yeah. Oh,
son?
Oh, yeah. Very many of those. Mm-hmm. We were the Renners were Catholic. Remember the Renner boy? But they came to us.
Right.
They came to us, and they were more fun, and they went right straight through the family, went right down to there. And I had all but the one. I think one went to Ursuline, and all the rest came to Rain. Was Arthur? Was he the one who went to Ursuline? Almost all the Rain boys came to Rain, and maybe Ursuline wasn't very prominent at that time. I'm not sure, but anyway, Mr. Renner said his boys were going to earn their living and. He wanted them to be mixed with all types, religion, all types of interests. And so they came, and there was George and Bill and Bob, and I worked with them a great deal at senior parties because they were lots of fun. And then I will say the Pegues family had a series of fathers and grandfathers, father and son, and one is superintendent of schools. I think he was probably the grandson of some people we had earlier. There was a whole family that came through.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there were quite a good many, great many families that it was just the thing to do, to go through high school and go to college.
Did you notice a similarity between each of them? A type of similarity?
Oh, you're very intelligent questions, but I, after all, I'm on the spot. I'm having to think offhand.
Oh, we understand that.
Yeah.
We expect the answers to be offhand, too.
Well, sometimes, you know, you could see in a boy, a character of his father, perhaps in the way he talked, the way he walked. I could say it was something going down the hall. I guess I could see there's a runner coming up, you know, or there's another Pegues arriving, or something of that kind. Of course, there were good. I just happen to think of those two families right now, but there were a good many families who never thought of anything else. You just, your father, your grandfather, your father, your son, you went right straight through Rain. Of course, for a great many years, it was the only school. So, I mean, that wasn't a tribute just to Rain, but it was the school, and they were Northsiders. Many of these are Northsiders, so they naturally would go to Rain. So, And we were rather, and when the first person in the family had been a great joy, you certainly welcomed those that came because you thought, well, probably there's enough of a strain that'll come through. But sometimes there was a little difference, you know, due to the general trend in life today. Maybe some of them, they didn't take it quite as seriously as their dads did or their grandfather did. Maybe they weren't quite as appreciative as their families were. But they were really, I was rather glad. I was always glad to get somebody, oh, I found another one of that family. I like that family. They have togetherness in the family. So we'll have togetherness here in school. Come from families where they all pull together, you know, like to get them to pull together with other people when they come to school.
As you look back, would you say that your feelings toward the Ray School were the same in 1958 when you were ready to leave as they were in, say, 1921 or 1929 or whatever?
Just as loyal. Mm-hmm. Just as loyal, yes.
But same feeling, say, toward the students or toward the faculty?
Toward the faculty, yes. I had some very, by the time I pulled out, I had lost my best friends. Mm-hmm. And you're bound, of course, to miss them on the faculty. You miss not only their personality, but you miss what they are offering, what they're offering people. I felt at the end that I wasn't able to give them quite as much as I had. So I left. But I pulled out several years before I had to. Then I went down to the university,
right,
and I taught there 9 years.
Did you find that a better experience than
a very different one and very valuable to me, mostly for physical reasons, given too much. As you can see, for different things,
right,
I did. Mr. Lindsay, he begged me to stay. He begged me to stay. He said, we need you. We need your kind of person on the faculty. And I said, I'm sorry, I've given it all I have. I can't take 7:30 in the morning to 5 at night. Can't do it. I can't even take 8 in the morning until 5 at night. Because after school, people would come in and talk with me, you know, sometimes, and talk things over. And I said, no, I can't do that. I just can't do it. And fortunately, I come from the kind of family that we all pulled together. And we were well educated, and we knew the problems that went with teaching. If you were conscientious. And so my brother said, no, you're not going to teach anymore. And I said, you've done your duty. You've gone way beyond it. He said, I think you've gone, but you know, brothers are sort of partial.
Right.
He said, I think you've gone way beyond the line of duty. So he said, I think you better stop now and have a little fun. And so I stopped, and I had no sooner stopped. So I said to Mr. Lindsay, I said, yes, if the Board of Education would let me teach two classes in the morning at 1/3 salary, I'd stay another 2 or 3 years. They said, I could see why they couldn't, you see. They did it for me, they'd have to do it for other people, and they get into all kind of involvement. So I didn't push it at all. I said that sort of off the cuff, Mr. Lindsay. I meant it in a way, but in another way I didn't, because it never occurred to me that they would. So the minute I got through Youngstown University, he said, now you can come to us.
What was your salary when you retired from Rand?
When I retired? I think something like $6,000.
Did you notice any other teachers at the Rand School retiring early for maybe similar reasons?
I think most of them stayed till 70. Most of them, I thought they should. But of course, I had a backing, and my brother said, he's a big insurance man, and he said, I don't want you to teach, you're too tired. And he said, you stop. And he said, if you need any money, I'm back of you. nice feeling, very nice feeling. And so I stopped. I said, I thought it was wise. Of course, just before I stopped, I had fallen, broken my arm and my leg. They told me I couldn't do that. I broke my left leg and my right arm. And they said, in the same fall. And I said, I'm too tired. On the way home from school, I can hardly get home.
You were walking home then?
I'm walking home. I'm living here. I'm walking from school. I'm walking down Ohio. Coming down home. And I lost consciousness. I had worked until 5:30. And so I came to, looked around, I was on the sidewalk. And two women were going by in a car. It was like the Good Samaritan in the Bible. And one of them got out, and she came across, and she saw me, and she said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "I don't know." And they said, "Can you stand?" And I said, "I don't know, why?" So the other one came over and they got me up, and I realized I'd done something, I didn't know what, but they put me in the car and drove me home. And Forrest and I had a little friend here who shares a house with me. I wasn't home from school yet, she's in Harding. And I got in the house and I lay down on the couch. They said, "Do you want us to stay?" I said, "No, I'm fine. I think I'd probably just turn my ankle." You know how you do, you just turn your ankle. I said to them, I knew there was something more, but I didn't know what it was. And I said, "Thank you very much. I appreciate being taken home." And so Florence came in and she said, "What are you doing lying down on the couch?" And I said, "Well, I fell." And she said, "I'm going to get the doctor for you right away." So she went, and Dr. Coombs was just leaving his office. And she said, "I think Miss Boynton has hurt her leg." And he says, "I'll come right down." So he came right down. Here in 20 minutes, he was here. He called the hospital right away. And in a half an hour, I was over the South Side Hospital in a cast up to my here, up here. And I said, "You know," he said, "Yes, you broke your leg right through." And I said, "My arm hurts a little bit. You better look at that." And so they x-rayed that. "Yes, you broke your arm too." But he said, "How could you do it in one fall? How could you do one side and the other side in one fall?" Well, I said, "You know, I was brought up to do unusual things." Anyway, so then I was out of school for 3 months. And I taught the rest of the spring, I taught the spring term. And then I decided that I was too tired. So I stopped and went down to university. And I had like two classes. And that was, oh boy, if I could have had that the last 10 years of teaching, you know. Of course, I wouldn't give anything for my experiences at RAND, I'll have to say that. They meant a lot to me. I learned a lot. Sometimes I thought I learned as much as the students did. Because in preparing a lesson, I saw new angles to things that I hadn't seen as a student. But as a teacher, I saw something new. So when I went down there, Mr. Dykema, who was there then, said, "What do you want?" Because I couldn't. He didn't say you can have the things the teachers here who have been here all years. He was just sensible. He just said, "What would you like?" And I said, "Well," he said, "we need you very much in the beginning, in the beginning class, because you know what they were in high school. You know what to expect." And he said, "You can have two freshman classes. You can have three freshman classes. You can have one freshman class." I said, "I'll start with two." So I started with two. I had two freshman classes. And I did a lot of the same kind of thing I did at RAND. They came early, and I stayed late. I mean, after class, because I was home by noon. It was heaven, because I was overdoing. I was having the fun of teaching, and I was having the fun of students, and I loved you all. You know, I mean, loved all the students. I enjoyed them. I enjoyed every minute of them. And they seemed to enjoy class, which of course meant a lot to me. But I never had more than two classes. And I'd had them sometimes in the first and second period in the morning. And I'd teach either Tuesday and Thursday, or Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Mm-hmm. And those days I didn't teach, of course I had a lot of papers to do, because you don't know how many times you have to write down there. But I enjoyed them, and I some, about two nights a week, I would give over the papers. But I'd have at least 2 days a week when I just did nothing but nothing I didn't want to do. I could just go downtown and shop. I could go call on my friends. I could go to the hospital. I did volunteer work up at the hospital here in the maternity ward. Of course, that was the only way I'd get in the maternity ward. But anyway, it was fun. It was fun. I mean, I did 1 day a week up there, one morning a week. And I got to know the hospital. I never had a chance to go to the hospital except as a patient. And I got to know the personnel. I felt that 8 or 9 years of teaching only 2 classes instead of 5 every day gave me an education in itself.
You taught 9 years after you left the room?
But only in a part-time.
Mm-hmm.
Be sure to put part-time.
Okay, fine.
Never more than classes. Never more than 2 classes. But I had, there were several people in the English faculty that I enjoyed down here. I was out with some of them the other day. It's Mrs. Schaefer, you know. Because Mrs. Einstein lived right across the street here. Because she's been very ill. And, a lot of people, about 3 or 4 on the faculty, and President Jones and his wife had me over their house a good many times had me over twice for dinner. And everybody was nice to me. Every place I've gone all my life, people have been good to me. So I could afford to do others. You see, it's a two-way street. And if people are good to you, you're likely to be good to them. Or if you're good to other people, they're likely to be good to you. I found life very rewarding.
Okay. Anything else you want to say, or you feel you've said enough?
I think I've said too much.
Not really. It was very good.
Well,
thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
This is an interview with Ms. Mary Louise Boynton for the Youngstown State University Oral History Project concerning the Rayen School. It's being done by Mark Conley at Ms. Boynton's residence on October the 29th, 1974, at approximately 11 a.m. Hey, Ms. Boynton, would you talk a little bit about your educational background?
Well, I was fortunate to be trained at Erasmus Hall High School, Brooklyn, New York, and then Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. And then I had my master's degree at Columbia University, and my master's degree at New York University. And I didn't take my master's degree until after I had been teaching here several years, so that I had a fund of information that I could use in all my classes, so that made it rather interesting for me. I think that's probably all you need to know. I came from a family where they had my father was the head of the history department at Erasmus Hall High School for a great many years, and so the feeling of being on the faculty had been part of my life for a great many years.
Okay, you were now Erasmus High School. Where was that at?
It's in Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn, that's where you were born?
No, I was born in Victor, New York. Victor, New York.
How far away is that from?
Victor is near Rochester, New York. Near Rochester, New York.
Okay. Do you think your father had any real influence on?
Oh, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly, because he was so very happy in his work. He was the head of the history department
mm-hmm.
at Erasmus Hall High School. And so we're brought up with faculty people and people who talked our language and very interesting people, people that you like to have at your dinner table because they had something worthwhile to offer, things like that interested me.
How did you end up in Youngstown?
Well, that's a whole story in itself, and I couldn't tell you too much about that, but I came here on the advice of a former teacher of Rayen years and years ago. She had been here. And she said, if there's any school in the United States where I think you belong, It's Rand School, Youngstown, Ohio. And I was about to change positions. I had taken a term off to tutor a girl for a very important examination, and so I stopped where I was teaching, and I said, I'm going to stop now and decide later what I want to do. So she said, let me write to Mr. Miller. He was the principal at that time, Mr. Edmund Miller, and Mr. O.L. Reed was the superintendent. And she said, let me write and ask him if by any chance there's an opening. So she wrote, and they wrote right back to her, and they said, your description of Miss Boynton makes us want her on our faculty. But unfortunately, every position at present is taken for the fall. This was in July. Every position is taken for the fall. But if anything opens up, oh, I do hope we can have her, because the kind of person she is and makes us feel that she would be happy here at Rand.
What year was this?
Big fun.
What year was this?
This is 1921.
Okay.
1921.
And how long have you been teaching up until then?
Up until then? Mm-hmm. Well, I've been teaching ever since 1914. I taught in Long Island, on Long Island. I taught in all during the war years. I had taught in Narberth, Pennsylvania, and then I came here. But then I did a piece of private tutoring, and then I came here. So then the very next mail, after Mr. Miller had received that letter, he got a resignation from an English teacher of his, and she said she was sorry, but she was not coming back to Rand for the fall, and the position would be vacant. So he sent immediately a special delivery to me saying, please come, please send us your qualifications, which I did, and they sent right and said, oh, we want you very much. So that was 1921, and I taught here 37 years. But in the meantime, I took one term off and went to California, taught in a private school. I didn't want to get in a rut, you see. I just thought I wanted something different.
What year was this?
1926. I taught in the Pasadena private school for a term. And then in 1931, I went to New York University and took my master's degree. So that I felt I had a chance to get away from it a little while and then come back, you see.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you came here, at the Rand faculty, did you feel that most of the other members on the Rand of the Rand School faculty were as well educated as you were?
I think they were it was a remarkable group. It really was a remarkable group. And I felt that we had one big happy family with many fine students, many preparing for college, and a faculty of high standards. Many really were tops in their field. If there was any jealousy among them, and perhaps there was, I wasn't aware of it. I felt we were all pulling together to give our students the very best education possible for them. As young, many of us were very young at the time, and so we attended the football game. We went, because we had a fine football team, especially in 1924. We went to the football games, and I think the whole faculty, with all the various departments, offered a great deal. I said, as I look back, I sometimes think what an opportunity the Rand students were offered. There were so many departments to meet so many needs, so many interests, and some students from both black and white were there to learn. I don't know if that's always true today.
Is that far back as 1921?
Mm-hmm. There were some students. We didn't have so many colored. We had some. But we had, and then of course they grew more and more. So now there's I don't know what the proportion is, but there are many more now. And, but there were some from the colored families as well as white that were there to learn. And I thought they had a wonderful opportunity offered to them.
Were there very many ethnic distinctions made at Rand at this time?
I think it might, in the early days, no. I think in the early days, you didn't notice it. But I think perhaps later on, it became more evident or more apparent.
When did you realize this evidence of this?
Well, I pulled out in 1958. And there hadn't been too much before that. But I understood that after that, there was more. But I didn't know. I wasn't particularly aware of it. I think there was a great stress made on togetherness in the school. I was aware of it in a good many cases. We had faculty meetings once a month, and they were prepared faculty meetings. We had faculty picnics occasionally. We had the luncheon after commencement, really an affair, something we looked forward to. And there were many clever tributes made to any of the faculty who were retiring. There were senior parties, and I happened to be on committee for senior parties for many years. And that's when we got to know, of course, the students who worked with us on senior parties. They're clever. They were really clever. I mean, the students themselves, we cooperated with them. Well, the students themselves were really very clever in working out these parties.
I have a question on students. What was the relationship between the teacher and the student?
Well, don't they use the word rapport a good deal? I think we had that. I think we had a good rapport. Mm-hmm. When we met them on the bus, I never had a car, so I had to go on the bus. I really walked to school most of the time. But when we met them on the street, it was a case of, hi, you know. And they seemed to be glad to see us, and I was glad to see them.
So it was a very friendly sort of relationship.
Very friendly relationship between the faculty and the student.
But did you still retain the dignity of the position?
A certain sense of dignity, yes. They never were fresh. They never were rude or rude. But you could feel a kind of a happiness, a happy friendliness among the students. Once in a while, you'd probably find someone that wouldn't agree with that, but for the most part, I think that was very evident most of the time we were there. So the senior parties helped this idea of togetherness, too. And then I said all those other things that really, really helped them. And it was at a time when TV didn't play as big a part in the life of a student, and she had time or took time to stay at home. And I think families were more together then. I mean, they pulled together as a family, and the fathers and mothers were interested in the success of their children. And then, of course, the commencement exercises were really beautifully done. I mean, they were planned way ahead, and they were carried out so beautifully. And, of course, I was not only taught there 37 years, but I was dean of girls for 11 years. And in that 11 years, when I was dean of girls, I didn't teach as many classes, but I got to know the girls very well. And of course, I realized that we had all kinds.
What sort of problems did you encounter among the students when you were a dean of girls?
Well, let's see, I'm trying to think. Also, to me, they came. When they weren't doing particularly well in their lessons, or possibly something of that kind, they'd come in and talk things over. Or sometimes they had home problems, and they wondered if they'd come talk it over. Of course, I was always glad to do it, but sometimes I wasn't sure I could get them the help.
It's interesting. What sort of home problems were encountered by girls in the 1920s?
Wanting to go with a kind fellow that their parents didn't think was good enough for them. So they'd come and talk it over. And one case, can you stop that? In talking to the girls, sometimes they would come in and ask if I could tell them how they could make themselves more attractive. And sometimes, of course, I had had them when they were ill, and talked over problems of illness with them. Because at that time, we didn't have someone who could take care of the ill girls who were ill. So in my office, I had those who were ill and those who had problems at home. And sometimes the problems at home had to deal with parents not understanding them, which I suppose is true today, which they claim is true today. And sometimes a girl, well, I can remember one time at least, when a girl became pregnant with a boy whom her parents disliked very much, and they had forbidden her to go with him. And she was on the brink of leaving town, running away, and she came in to talk it over with me, and I was very glad she did. She was a very nice youngster that just got involved without realizing the consequences. And she said that I suggested that she tell her parents and face it and see what could be done about it. And she said, oh no, they wouldn't. They practically kill me. And so after talking with her quite a while, she agreed that she would appear in my office with her parents, and I could tell them if she wouldn't. So they came up one day, a father and mother. It was one of the hardest things I ever had to do, but it seemed to me the only thing I could do to make it fair to her. And so when they came in, and then she came in, and I told them that we had something to talk over, and that I'm sure that none of us were so perfect but what we made mistakes sometimes, and that their daughter had perhaps made a mistake, at least she wasn't sure, and they might think it was a mistake. And I had advised that she tell them, and that they talk it all together, because I had always come from the kind of family where you talk things over, and that was the way we had solutions. So we talked it over, and I told them what the name of the boy, because she had told me that, and the name of the fact that she was pregnant. Of course, they were terribly shocked at first. And in those days, that kind of thing was more unusual, at least coming to light. And I just suffered. I suffered more than, well, I think I suffered more in that interview than any other one interview I had in all my 11 years as Dean of Girls. And finally, to make a long story short, they agreed to have the boy come down to the house and see what could be done about it. And he did come down to the house later on, and he married the girl. They left town, went to the West. Nobody ever heard about them again here, but I think the mother and father kept in touch with them, so it came out all right. But there was a need for that personal touch, and I think there is today a need for a personal touch, especially from someone who isn't necessarily so shocked but what she would see a thing through. And they were very appreciative. I mean, the mother and father thanked me afterwards.
Now, this is obviously demonstrate understanding on your part.
Yeah.
What about the rest of the faculty? If they found out, did they find out about this, and how did they react?
Nobody with this girl and me.
Okay,
no,
fine.
Nobody.
Okay.
No, we just talked it over, and the family talked it over, and I think she left. It was pretty near the end of the term, and she finished the term. This boy married her, and they went west, where I think she had a relative, and they set up a new life for themselves. And the last I heard, everything was going all right.
Mm-hmm. About what year was this?
Mm-hmm.
Was this in the 20s?
It was sometime in the 20s, but I can't remember just when. Probably just before 1930, anyhow.
Okay.
Yeah. Say in the 20s sometime. And then, of course, my job was also to get positions for girls after school. And I was too conscientious for my own health. That's why I stopped before I got to be 70. I was too tired. But I felt there was a great need for that. And so girls would come in and sign up. They want to earn money, outside of school. And they would be babysitters. They would sit for people who wanted to go out in the evening. And I suppose they had about 10 or 15 girls on the list. And I talked with them, and I tried to make them see the importance and the responsibility they had in taking care of a child. It was very, very important for them to be dependable when the mother and father were out. And they should never leave, never let the parents leave the house not knowing where the parents would be all evening. And they understood that. And then I went outside of school hours. I went and met the parents that wanted these girls and told them we had these girls and that I would send one, but I wanted to know what they expected too. And so most of the cases were worked out very nicely, and the girls earned money that they could use for their school expenses. They were all the girls that needed money. And only once was I challenged at 2 a.m. in the morning. I had a phone call from one of the girls who was sitting at babysitting way out in the country. And the mother and father had gone off, and in their hurry, they had let her know where they were going. And the baby had croup, a developed croup. And she was frantic because the baby couldn't swallow. She didn't know what to do. And so she called me. She was the only person. So I said, what'll I do? What'll I do? What'll I do? She said, he can't breathe. And so I said, you know the family doctor? No. Well, then I said, you call your doctor. Tell him the symptoms. Tell him what it is. Ask him what to do. And bless his heart, he came out. He came out to where she was. And they took care of that baby. And when the parents came home, they didn't. They just knew the baby had croup, it was better. I think they realized what that child had done. Directly, of course, I had been a little bit of help in getting the doctor there. The baby got well, and I said, now, I called the girls and after that, and I said, have I ever told you before? Tell you again, don't ever leave. Don't ever let a parent leave the house without knowing where I used to be. Now, I said, she hadn't been able to get me. I told Miss Instance, she hadn't been able to get me. And we hadn't been able to get a doctor. As the child said, the baby was so croupy, it could hardly breathe. And she was frantic. But so that's the kind of thing that we tried to do. Now, but we weren't perfect either. I mean, as faculty, I'm sure we made mistakes. But in that way, I think probably personally, I was able to help. I've been many times as a dean of girls. I had a contact that I perhaps didn't have with just the faculty. Although some of the students in my classes would come to me when they didn't have to and just said, what are we going to do? My mother doesn't see why I should have any fun. She thinks I should spend all my evening studying, and I'm going to hate school. Now, what can we do about it? And she said, if mother comes up sometime, will you tell her that after all, there are two sides to education, and that's very important to do your schoolwork well, but it's also very important for young people to have a good time. And so that was one family. I had a very beautiful present from that girl not too long ago because she seemed to think I had helped her. I don't know how I did because she seemed to think so anyhow.
Obviously, you know, this being dean of girls took a lot of your time. Obviously, this being dean of girls took up a lot of your time.
Yes.
Did you ever feel it was interfering with your teaching at all?
Well, I used to think it was it didn't so much interfere with my teaching, but it meant that I limited my life at home because I had three classes, and I used to say laughingly, I'd go from teaching romantic poetry and English literature. I had seniors, you know, my seniors are my specialty. Romantic poetry and senior English. And I'd go back to my office and find a very sick girl, and I had to take care of her. Then I'd come back and teach something to juniors. And then generally, I think they tried to give me most of my classes in the morning. And I was always to have somebody in my office, and my office was just down the hall. So if they needed me, they could come and get me. I preferred a strict teaching position. Or a street dean of girls, but the Board of Education felt they couldn't hire just a dean of girls. They had to have someone who could also teach. And so I had to teach three classes along with the other and help take care of the senior parties, go to football games, help with the German club. I had charge of German club. And so some months I felt I was working too hard to do the kind of work I wanted to do.
Did that give you a pay increase?
Oh,
no.
Just had a regular salary.
Even with the added responsibilities?
Yes, because I felt I was just there all day. See, I had three classes, but the dean of girls had to be part of my schedule. I think we all had equal equal salaries for equal preparation.
But so it was sort of like you were on almost 24-hour duty, wasn't it?
Well, I don't think people realized it. And I wasn't the kind of person to talk. I wasn't much of a talker about it. And any of the problems that came to me, came between the girls and me, never went any further. In fact, that's the first time I ever told this. And that's just because you wanted to see the relationship between some of our faculty and the students. Now, I'm sure some of the rest of the faculty, too, talk things over with the students, not officially, as I did as Dean of Girls, but I'm sure many of them, in, especially in the business department, with which I had no contact. You see, I was you had to prepare for college, preparatory college. But I'm sure many of those people in that department talked to their young people, too, before and after class and mornings. And many a time, we also had to coach for college entrance examinations. And that was, they just expected us to coach for them. And I look back on it now, I don't know how I ever did it. I really do. I don't know how I ever did it. Of course, I suppose I was young and strong and well and happy, and the students were pulling with me. And I just never thought that I couldn't do it, so I did it. But I think I came to the place where I said to Mr. Miller, "Well, I don't want this position of Dean of Girls. I want a straight teaching position." And he said, "Well, people love the position of Dean of Girls." I said, "I took it because you asked me to, not because I wanted it, because you asked me to." And I said, "I have done the best I can with it. I've served 11 years, and I find it very difficult to combine, to do that well, and teach as I like to teach. And so I'd like the next year to go back to my teaching position." I said, "There are other people on the faculty who would like this position. They don't know what it is, but they'd like it. But they'd like this prestige. They thought it was prestige. I never thought especially about it one way or the other." And I said, "Give it to someone else." And so I had a few years then of just being on the faculty with a regular teaching position and three senior classes and one German class, one freshman class, I think.
From what year to what year were you Dean of Girls?
Well, I'm afraid you'd ask me that.
Well, approximately.
I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure about that.
Was it soon after you came
here? No, it was, Mrs. Peterson was there. She was one of the famous teachers who years ago, Mrs. Peterson, Mrs. Baldwin. When we came here, we were taught to know that they were the outstanding teachers, and of course they were. They were wonderful teachers. But when Mrs. Peterson left the position of Dean of Girls, and then I went in, and I suppose it was someplace in the 30s, but I don't know. I don't know, I'm not sure, but I tell you who would know, though. You see, all these records of time should be in the Wynn files.
Right.
And Clark White, who was principal, and who lives in Poland now, could tell you where those records are if they aren't up here at Rand.
Clark White.
Clark White.
He was principal.
He was principal of Rand. Just before, he was the last principal of Rand, just before this new one, before Katsoulis came in.
Okay.
Yes. And I think the fact that we were able to do as much as we did at Rand was a feeling of cooperating between the faculty and the students, and the fact that we always felt that most of the families were behind us, were with us, pulling with us, and they knew we were doing our work as well as we knew how.
What about the relationship between the faculty and the administration? Say, for example, Mr. Miller during the 20s.
That's fine. See, we had I went through four administrations, and every one of them, there was a very happy relationship. At least, as far as, I suppose there were a few now and then, you know, had their troubles. But as far as I was concerned, I had a very happy relationship through 1, 2, 3, 4. What do you call them? Four
regimes.
Yeah, regimes, I guess you would say. I think there was a very happy relationship. And you felt that in faculty meetings. I think in the faculty meetings you noticed it. And I think that the fact that the faculty as a whole, too, back to teams, went to the basketball games, went to the football game. I had a great many football men in my class. And I would help them immediately before and after class because some of them needed a little help. But I think there was a very happy relationship.
Did you notice any differences in, say, the four principals under whom you worked?
In personalities, yes, but not so much in them. They all seem to have the same ideal, good education for every student there, that each student should be considered and be given a good education.
They all have the same ideal on how to get this good education to the student?
Well, I don't know that they talked about that especially. The idea was just to bring out the very best you can and every student you have. I think that was very, very important.
So there was sort of a free rein to the teacher?
Yes, you had, we had a course of study. Each department had a course of study. And in your senior English, for instance, there were certain things we had to cover. Because, of course, there might be changes, shift from one class to another, and you'd want to have that, be able to do that easily. So you had your course of study, but when I think of the personalities on the department, I know there must have been a free reign because we all handled it somewhat differently.
For example, how did you handle your class? Let's say the 1920s or 30s?
Well, the 1920s, well, of course, I tried to be very definite in my assignments. I think that's very important. And then, a great many times, we would talk things over in class. That is, I would throw out a subject that was supposed to be discussed that particular time, and I'd say, let's talk about this. Or we were talking about Wordsworth and Coleridge and Keats and Shelley and all of those, which is one of my specialties. I love to teach them. And I didn't realize it at the time, but of course I had been in England and I had seen Wordsworth's home, and I had seen these places he talked about, the daffodils and all that, so that I told about it with a good deal of a feeling of having been there. But I never said I saw Wordsworth. I simply said I was visiting Wordsworth's home. And I did say, for instance, I saw the place from which, about which he wrote his daffodils, one of his famous poems. So I guess it was about a year after that, I met the mother of one of my boys, and she said, I have a good joke to tell you. And I said, what's that? And she said, we were talking ages the other night. My son said, well, Miss Boynton and Wordsworth, you know, were close friends, so they must have been about the same age. That was the 18s. And she said, I said, well, how old do you think Miss Boynton is? Well, she said, she and Wordsworth were very close friends. And she said, they used to roam the hills together. And she said, did she say that? Well, no, she didn't say that, but she said she must have known him or she couldn't have talked about him as she did. See, he ran that, jumped to that conclusion. And she said, well, I don't think she knew. I said, I think Wordsworth had died before Miss Boynton came to reign. But he said, nevertheless, I think she'll be interested in knowing that you felt she put it across, as far as that's concerned. I always felt that the principal and the vice principal were backless, as they would cooperate with the faculty. I thought it was very important that they did, and I think I always felt that if I wanted anything, I'd just go and talk it over. But I'd had so much experience before I came here that I very seldom went. I never went in for petty things. I handled those myself. But if there was a real problem, well, then I went in. But most of the things, I would say that three-fourths of the faculty handled their own disciplinary problems, and that's the other third took the disciplinary problems to the office because they all seemed to have enough to do there.
So there really was what you would consider a tight ship at Rain as far as the administration's handling of the school.
A tight ship?
You know what I mean?
They were back of you. They were back of you, but they let you have a great deal of leeway in presenting your material. And that's one of the reasons I kept on, because I had some very nice offers to go other places. Mm-hmm. And I had, when I went west to teach for those 6 months, I didn't go to teach, but when I got there, my money ran out. And so I went into a teacher's agency, and I said, you happen to want a teacher? And they said, can you teach English? And I said, I think so. And they said, could you be a vice principal? And I said, well, I don't know, I never have been. And they said, well, they're a very fine private school. The vice principal has just resigned, and you go up and see the principal. That was Friday. So I went up to see the principal. And she said that she interviewed me and told me what I had done. Could I give any references? I said, you can go to any school where I've ever taught. These are the places I've taught. And she said, I don't think I will. And she said, will you come Monday morning? So I started writing and teaching. Private school.
What differences did you notice at the private school from the Reagan school?
That's a hard thing to answer. You see, they lived in. It was a private school where they lived in, and we had children from old children whose parents wanted to go abroad and wanted to take them with them up through the senior year. And I think that you were constantly under guidance. See, they lived right in the house, and so we knew all the time what they were doing. We ate dinner with them. We had a very close contact, contact with them. And they finally said, can you put out a yearbook? I said, what? I did a yearbook? And they said, yes, we have to put out a yearbook. And the vice principal, Johnny, does that. And I said, well, I never have. And they said, you think you could? Of course, I was very young then, about 1926. I said, oh, I think I could. They asked me now, I said, oh, no, I couldn't. But I thought then I could, and I did. It would help, you know, very good help. But it was interesting. I think these were from families. I say the children were all family, from families that had gone away and left them, you know, there. And so you had to have a very close contact. And you taught them manners. At the dinner table, everybody was taught manners. I mean, you didn't get up and finish dinner and put things aside and go upstairs. You waited until everybody was finished. And you were taught courtesy for the other fellow. You were taught consideration for the other fellow. We were taught in the English class, we talked about some modern things that were going on in the world, not so much as it would today, but we did some. We went shopping with them. We had to go shopping, we had to go downtown. We went to theater with them. It was an entirely new experience, but it made my life richer. And I found I could give a lot of things to students that perhaps I couldn't have done before, because I had been West. I hadn't been West before. And had been West, and I'd been on a ranch. I lived on a ranch, and I had taught in a private school, and I had gone to the playhouse. I acted in the playhouse here one time, and so I finished in the playhouse, and I went to the playhouse there and had a very interesting time.
Now, when you came back to the Reagan School, did you have a new perspective?
Well, I think I was refreshed and everything else. I think I had seen a little more of the world, and I had become acquainted with people of, of course, I've been acquainted with the children that came from families who had plenty of money, or they wouldn't be sending them where they did. And I mean, I think it was more a matter of being refreshed, and I'm glad to come back. Mr. Miller said, you know, he was very stern and a very good disciplinarian. So I told him I wanted to go. He said, I don't want you to go. And I said, well, I think I better go now. The time will come when I can't go. This is an interesting offer for me. I went with my aunt. And so I said, I hope you'll feel all right about it, but I'm going. I want to go. And he said, well, I can't promise you a job when you come back. But there's a twinkle in his eye. And I said, no, I don't imagine you could. But I said, I'm willing to take a chance. So I went. And before I came back, I said, is my job still there? He said, it certainly is.
Was the money better? Were you getting a higher salary at the private school than you were there? No. Okay.
Much more money here. Much better salary here. No, I had only $100 a month, plus Birmingham board. And but here, of course, at that time, it wasn't such a big salary, but it was. I think I came in for $2,200 when I came here. That was my salary. Mm-hmm. But that had been a jump from $1,400. That I'd had in Pennsylvania all through the war years, you know, I had taught. And through the war years, I had nursed at night. I had taught by day, and I had done the voluntary nursing by night up until about a week before the armistice, when I took nursing up until midnight, and I slept from midnight until 8 o'clock the next morning. And I was so young and so well and so strong, I thought I could do it forever. And I did until a week before the armistice when I was taken with flu and was very, very ill.
So you worked two jobs during the war?
Yeah, one was unpaid.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get any money for volunteer service, mm-hmm. but it meant I had to go in places where they couldn't afford a nurse.
Right.
And I just went in and gave medicine and I don't know what I did to cheer them up if I could. But there wasn't anybody else to do it, so several of us faculty did it. Two or three of other faculty. This is in Narberth, Pennsylvania. And as I say, a week before the armistice, I had gotten too tired. In other words, I wasn't what you call a person who could take everything forever and get away with it. I'd given every strength I had.
Right.
So the week before, I went down with flu and I was very, very sick. So sick that they thought I was going to die. But I didn't.
Now, when you say you received $2,200 at RAND, would you consider that a comfortable salary for that period?
For that period, yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, what about when the Depression hit?
Well, I stretched my money. I made a goal. And the funny part of that was, I can't remember exactly. What that came, 29, didn't it?
Right.
29.
Crash.
Because I was getting more of 29, and this was in 2200. I came here with 2200. That's what I remember. And then, of course, it went up each year. So I don't know what I was getting in 29, but it was more than that, of course. And I was living in people's homes, and I didn't have any car.
How far away from the school did you live?
Oh, just a block or two.
Most of the faculty lived fairly close to the school?
Most of them. I would say most of them lived near the school. A few. We had two from the south side, I think.
You say you were living in other people's homes, like you rented out?
Yeah, I rented a room. Mm-hmm. Rented a room. And I had about five different places I lived in 37 years. But all very nice homes. People were very good to me. It was more reasonable, of course, than running your own home. But when the Depression came along, I had my salary. I wouldn't take another cent from my father because he'd been too generous. And my uncle worried about me because he thought, I'm afraid she's not going to have enough money. And so he called my father and he said, "You think we should send Louise some money?" And my father said, "No, not unless she asks for it." He said, "She'll manage. She's always managed." And I'd gone down to the bank the week before, put some in, but I had my salary check, and it hadn't been cashed. So when the Depression came along, here I had my salary check, and so I could get it cashed after. Well, I don't know how I got it. One of the banks cashed it for me, and so I had that to live on.
For a period, didn't the school withhold the checks for a while during the Depression? They couldn't pay the salaries?
I don't remember that. I really don't remember it. Maybe somebody would, but I didn't happen to remember it.
Mm-hmm. So really, you didn't feel yourself suffering that much during
the
Depression?
No, I didn't. I didn't because, as I say, I didn't spend a lot of extra money on clothes. I didn't have a car. And I lived in the people's homes. I had a room. And I knew that if I was pushed too hard, I had a family back of me that would help out.
What about students during the Depression? Did you notice a change in their attitude?
I'm not aware of it,
okay.
Especially.
Fine.
I wasn't aware of it. I suppose maybe the time I did, but it's been a long time since.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to tell anything I'm not sure of.
Okay. When you were teaching there, were there any special rules, you know, which you had to adhere to as a woman teacher?
No, of course you had women's restroom and the men's restroom, but I mean, no, nothing more.
No difference in salary?
No.
A man was not being paid more for doing the same job as you?
I don't think so. I think the salaries were even.
Mm-hmm. Now, what, for example, there was no rules of conduct outside of the school either for teachers in general or women teachers or whatever?
I don't think there's need for it. I can imagine anybody on the faculty needing it. Well, I can't imagine normal. I can't imagine many people on the faculty needing it.
Mm-hmm.
No, we just, as a matter of fact, when I look back, I don't know how I ever did, because you see, I gave book reviews for clubs. And on top of correcting papers for seniors at night. I prepare book reviews. And then I would, I know, I'd have this, because I belong to AUW. And I was president of AUW one year here. And then different clubs would depend on me for book reviews. So I would give a book review, sometimes on a Friday night, you know, or so, at this club. Always gave them an evening when I wasn't working otherwise. So I could help out in the life of the city. And I felt I got to know people much better than I would if I had never offered anything.
Interesting question. You were there when the move took place between the old Grand School to the new Grand School. What new facilities did you find in the new school, which you didn't have in the old, or which possibly new other school around here had?
Well, you see, I was there just a little while, the last year. So I really didn't know too much about the facilities down there. But when we came up here, I think it was mostly the science laboratories that they had. There was a big deal of advance in that. But as far as I myself was concerned, I had a much better room, a much beautiful room. And I think the offices were better equipped. And of course, we had a very good cafeteria, all those advantages that came in, and the cafeteria was good. And the gymnasium, I think, was a big improvement. Many things that I didn't come in contact with personally, I think, were part of the new regime that people in different departments found very valuable. But with me, of course, we had wide halls. People visited in the halls. They had a good deal of visiting in the halls and at noon and at work school in the morning. And I think they got together that way a good deal.
Is this faculty and students together?
No, just students. No, the faculty were in our room. We were in our room. It was supposed to be at 8:15. I was there at 7:30.
7:30, preparing your classes or?
Well, if the students needed me, they always could come in at 8 o'clock, and they got stuck on something, you know, some little trouble. They'd come in and I would help them.
Can you describe just like a typical day? Say you get there at 7:30.
Oh.
A typical day in the 1920s for you.
Well, just before or after